Which banker wants to ban cash to trap you in his financial snare? And how Australia sacrificed its sovereignty to the five-eyed monster. Coming up in this week's episode of the Citizens Report. Welcome to the Citizens Report. It's the 4th of April 2024. I'm Robert Barwick and I'm joined today by Citizens Party researcher and editor Richard Barden. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Robbie.
In this week's show, we're going to talk about a banker who has decided to put his head above the parapet and suggest we put on a cash ban. I don't think he was paying attention last time this came up, Richard.
Definitely not reading the room.
But he is playing his hand. This is what they want. And I want to get through that fairly quickly because the second segment is quite important. We're going to do a fascinating history lesson here. Richard's got some interesting historical stories about how power was really formed in Australia, and it's mind-blowing stuff. And you can see why from these examples we are not a sovereign country. So let's get into it first, though. Remember, this is not just for information. We're activists. Help us get the message out. You can do that by liking the show, sharing it on all your social media, subscribing. And if you haven't subscribed already and you're doing it for the first time, remember to click the bell icon so you can get notified of updates as we do other presentations as well, not just the regular weekly show. For instance, this week, we'll talk about that in a second. This week, we put up a very important interview with Michelle Steinberg on what's happening over in the Middle East. Comment on the show beneath, please. We value your comments. Get the debate raging down there, and I join in as I can. And finally, donate. We need all the help we can get. We are taking on... The way the Citizens Party works is we are taking on what we have identified as the source of the corrupt power structures that are, you know, ruining our country. And that's why we focus so much on the banks and the banking system. And it's going after the head of the octopus rather than just the tentacles. And it's, it requires a lot of focus, a lot of work, and we need your support to make that happen. I've done a lot of travelling lately, and I've got more travelling coming up in a week or so, and we well and truly appreciate the contributions towards that. The Citizens Party is holding seminars around Victoria. These are for members and activists. These are members and activist forums. They're going to be nationwide, but I just want to talk about the Victorian ones. We know that many viewers of the Citizens Report who participate in our mobilisations would like to have these kind of discussions face-to-face. So we have three upcoming in Victoria, April 14th in southeast Melbourne at Noble Park, April 28th in the northern Melbourne in Fawkner-Hadfield area, and May 19th in Deer Park on the western side of Melbourne. So the co-founders of the Citizens Party, Craig and Noel and Isherwood, will be there giving presentations. I'll be there. And also giving a presentation and helping to have discussions with everybody present. And it's an open forum for people to talk. We've just had two of these in Brisbane, which our members who attended enjoyed immensely. Now, these are not open slather events, though. So they're invitation only. If you're interested in coming, please call our office on our toll-free number, 1-800-636-432. And ask to speak to an organiser about the process to register to come. All right, so that is 1-800-636-432. But if you see yourself as an activist, and you should, because if you've participated in our campaigns, you know, you have the capacity to participate in these things, and we really encourage you to do so. So if you haven't attended before, make that call, talk to an organiser, and hopefully we'll see you on the day. All right, now... Just a few quick updates also before we begin. Last week, Richard, Craig, Isherwood and I talked about the Julian Assange decision, and that's where the British court, the UK Courts of Justice, said the Assange team has leave to appeal unless the Americans can provide assurances that if he goes to the United States, if he's extradited, he can use the First Amendment as a defense, and which is the freedom of speech, and he won't be sentenced to death, right, if he's found guilty. He'll not get the death sentence. Those assurances are not worth the paper they're written on, right? Nevertheless, they may provide those. You would expect they would.
Well, and the Crown solicitors admitted as much in the court the last time they were in there. Said, well, you know, we can't. There's no plausible way they can give those assurances, right?
They can say he won't get the death sentence, but then isn't that the American government interfering with the American courts?
Mm-hmm.
But what we're told they don't do, right? We're told people have been making calls to the Australian government, and they're getting letters back saying, oh, we can't tell the UK government what to do because they can't interfere with the courts. Yet the UK court is asking the American government to interfere with the courts. And so there won't be. It's all a charade. Anyway, the point is, it's not really on the US government. It's not really on the UK government. It's on the Australian government. If we really had any self-respect as a country, we'd stand up for this guy. And it's time, as we said, that Albanese put our alliance on the line, and not the whole alliance necessarily, but key things, and say, you value these things from Australia, all bets are off until we get proper justice for Assange here, get him out. And believe me, if they wanted to, they could do it like that. So that comes from us putting pressure on the Albanese government. So last week we said make calls, and this week is the crucial week to make calls. We've got until the 16th of April for these calls to get through to them. And so we identified 12, we'll put the list again below that you can click on, 12 MPs to call, Albanese, Penny Wong, and the 10 most marginal Labor seats. Keep that up. If you haven't made those calls already, please do. Phone them and send emails to them demanding that they actually muscle up and take action for Assange here before the 16th of April, right? So that's very crucial. I just want to give an example of the kind of thing that WikiLeaks and Assange represents, because, like I said, and this is the segue to the next thing I wanted to talk about, we've just put up an interview with Michelle Steinberg, one of the co-authors of the dossier we've been talking about the history of this Temple Mount plot in Israel, right, that is driving the violence over there. And you've got to watch it, you know, if you haven't seen it already, please take the time and watch the interview, and there's links to the dossier below that. But this week, Richard, an Australian was killed by the Israelis in Gaza, who's an aid worker, Zomi Frankom, her name is, right? Mm. She's one of seven essentially Westerners who worked for this World Central Kitchen who were killed. And as it turns out, I mean, I don't know if you know more details than me, but it wasn't just a random strike. They struck and then they struck and they struck again. They struck three times this aid convoy, right, that had just offloaded a whole bunch of food at a warehouse in Gaza. I mean, this was deliberate and absolutely appalling. And Netanyahu says, this is the fog of war.
Misidentification was the word.
Even though the vehicles are white vehicles and they have these colour logos all over them.
Yeah, painted over the whole roof so that you can be seen from the air so that they don't drop bombs on you unless they're trying to.
Now, a few months ago, this is why I wanted to bring it back to Assange, you wrote an article based on information from people like Declassified Australian Peter Cronow about how Pine Gap is used to target the Israeli government's weapons that are going into Gaza, right? Pine Gap in the centre of Australia in Northern Territory, next to Alice Springs, Pine Gap. And so the question has been asked in the last 48 hours, was Pine Gap targeting involved in this strike as well? And think about what that means if it is. So here you have an installation on Australian soil being used to kill an Australian aid worker over there in Gaza. And it's horrible that we're singling out one Australian aid worker out of the more than 200 aid workers that have already been killed because they were Palestinians and no one cared about them, or the 30,000 plus Palestinian civilians that have been slaughtered in the last 6 months, right? But this is the sort of thing that does bring it home for Australians, and then you've probably seen the news that, you know, Albanese is under extra pressure. What Julian Assange created with WikiLeaks, Richard, is a system whereby if there is someone in Pine Gap with a conscience or has grown a conscience, if this is like, if this incident is like the straw that breaks the camel's back, and this person says, no, this is too much. Like, if what we suspect is happening, and this person says, this is too much. If he told people at Pine Gap it was going to go public, he'd be dead, right? I mean, I'm not just saying that metaphorically. I think he would be dead. WikiLeaks created, Julian Assange created WikiLeaks so that someone like that could leak information totally anonymously, totally untraceable.
Yeah, including to WikiLeaks itself.
Including to WikiLeaks itself, and the truth could come out, right? That's why Assange is the person they've got to make an example of. So that sort of thing doesn't happen. So we've talked about it. We're surmising there, right? It's a hypothesis. It's a well-founded one, but that's an example of the power of Assange. And like I said, you know, we need this guy. We have to defeat the evil system that's trying to make an example of him so the rest of us stay in our bunkers. That's what they're trying to do. And back to the interview I did with Michelle Steinberg, you know, we need all the resources we can to bring an end to this slaughter in the Middle East. Before, what we warn about in the interview, I want to put it this way slightly, people might relate to it. For the last 20 years, people are aware of religious extremism. What we're really aware of is Muslim extremism. And Muslim extremism is bad, right? It is bad. It is, you know, Wahhabi Saudi jihadist terrorism has been bad. ISIS, etc. And yes, Hamas gets into that, right? There is a side of Hamas that is like that, for sure. They are Muslim extremists. But unlike, say, ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, Hamas wasn't started by, you know, a rich construction worker's son, Osama bin Laden. Hamas was started by a guy whose family was massacred in 1948 in Palestine. And he was little. And when he grew up, he started Hamas, right? It's a slightly different thing. But these kind of circumstances create extremism. Right? So, yeah, but we always focus on that side. What we talk about is that's not what's driving this conflict. What's driving this conflict is equally dangerous extremists, even more dangerous extremists on the other side. And what makes them more dangerous, these Jewish extremists, is they have a timetable. Yeah.
And fundamentalist Christian extremists as well.
Backing them up, right? And they have a prophecy timetable in their head that they're following to bring back the Messiah. But to do it means blowing up the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which means World War III.
Yeah, and they know that, deliberately create, they want to bring on Armageddon.
They want it.
They want
Armageddon's
to bring on Armageddon.
In their prophecy.
Literally.
It's part of the prophecy. The worst possible outcome is what they want. And these people have always existed, except now they're in the Israeli government. Yeah. Right? The details are in the interview. Make sure you watch it. A couple of other things just before we get on to bankers, just to mention again, last week we talked about this petition that an excellent supporter, David Miller, has started about saving checks, right? So we'll put the link again below. Please help widely disseminate that change.org petition. And then, of course, there's the cash petition for the Jason Bryce Cash Welcome Cash and Banking Guarantee petition, which is up to over 167,000 signers now, which is a very big petition. And make sure if you haven't supported that, you support that and help distribute that as well. Because that brings us to our first story. Which banker wants to ban cash to trap you in his financial snare? And as I'm talking about this, I want the producer to put this article up on the screen from news.com.au. We'll start off by talking about what happened on Tuesday. Tuesday was Cash Out Tuesday. We mentioned it last week. By all accounts, it was a huge success. So news.com.au has a story up today about that, and we'll scroll through the screen so you can see that. And news.com.au has a very cheap business model, right? What they do is they scour social media. And they fill these articles with social media photos and comments. It's pretty easy journalism. Nevertheless, it's good to see it all in what someone's done it and put it all in one place. And there was a lot of people engaged in this, right? And it got the fact it was happening made all the news channels. And now the scale at which it's happened has been great. It certainly sent a message, I'm sure, to the bankers. There's even a member of parliament And there could have been more, but Lou O'Brien, who's a Nationals MP, he put this image of himself on Facebook drawing out cash. Now, that's called jumping on the bandwagon, but I don't mind when members of Parliament are jumping on the bandwagon. It confirms to us we've created the bandwagon, right? Mm. Never look to these guys to lead the fight, but once there's enough noise, right, and once the stampede's gone past them, they go, I got to better go and catch up to that one.
Yeah, when the history books are written, they'll have been there all along.
They will have been there all along, of course. Success has many fathers. It's failure that's an orphan. So look, that was excellent. The Australian people spoke with their feet there, right? They do not want the bank's cashless agenda. And besides not wanting it and all the reasons for not wanting it, we aren't ready for it. Mm.
It doesn't work anywhere. It didn't work in England. It didn't work in Sweden. It didn't work in Belgium. Why would it work here?
And they're much smaller countries where it's easy to roll out the communications infrastructure, etc. And it still doesn't work, right? We're a much bigger country. We have to have cash in this country. The whole thing would come to a screaming halt if the banks got their way. But they do want to get rid of cash. So the latest example, and this was. As soon as we heard this, everyone's ears pricked up. What? So we'll just play the tape. Which banker wants to ban cash? Well, that's a play on words for a certain age group. Of course, it's the Commonwealth banker, Matt Comyn, the CEO of the Commonwealth Bank, Australia's biggest banker, or as the ad would say, Australia's leading banker, Matt Comyn. And this is what he said last week at an Australian Financial Review function, where he was asked a question. Now, he was asked a question unrelated about productivity. He was running through a list of things that he reckoned would boost productivity. And in doing so, he chucked this in.
You know, stop any payments over $5,000, maybe even lower, $500. Make them all sort of electronic.
So, now that's a bit of a, that comes across as a bit of a thought bubble, Richard. A $5,000, no, $500 cash limit.
His tie probably cost more than that.
That's right. Hey, I guarantee you it bloody would have. Now, that's extraordinary. And we don't know how serious he is, except we do know the serious intention of the banks to get rid of cash. The reason we don't know necessarily how serious he is because anyone paying attention in 2019, 2020 should know you do not want to touch this, right? The Morrison government put up a bill to ban cash transactions over $10,000, and that triggered a massive grassroots campaign that we helped to lead, along with people like Martin North and John Adams. But we helped to lead that campaign, and that campaign was extraordinary. I mean, the biggest video I've ever done on YouTube to this day is still from that campaign, 170,000 people watch me talk to Martin North about the details behind the cash ban. We broke all sorts of records flooding the various inquiries with opposition to it, with submissions opposing it. And the politicians well and truly got the message. And by middle of 2020 or so, a little bit towards the end of 2020, they couldn't run away from it fast enough, right? The poor minister, and I'll call him the poor minister, Michael Sukkar, I mean, very soon he realised he'd been handed a poison chalice. He had no enthusiasm for this at all. And all the parties got the message. It wasn't just the Liberal Party or whatever. All the parties.
Yeah, and so when Malcolm Roberts put up a motion to dump it off the notice paper, it passed unopposed.
Everybody just, right? Labor wasn't interested. Liberals weren't interested. Nationals weren't interested. Greens weren't interested. They got rid of it. So if Aussies weren't going to come at a $10,000 cash ban, they're sure as hell not going to come at a $500 cash ban, Mr. Comyn. But what's in it for Matt Comyn? This is the thing. He put that there in the context of productivity. The number five he mentioned after the 500, he was talking about different ways for the government to raise extra revenue, and the five referred to $5 billion. He said a $500 cash ban will help the government collect $5 billion more in taxes because it'll stop people avoiding tax. That's what he was saying. In other words, cash helps people avoid tax. And I'm thinking, here we go again.
Yeah, where have we heard this before?
That's what they told us for the $10,000 cash ban. And the guy who's recommended it was the global chairman of KPMG, which has built a business model in helping the biggest companies and the richest people in the world avoid tax, right? And not $20 GST, billions and billions and billions. And that person turned around and had the cheek to say, the problem with the shadow economy in Australia is hairdressers, tradies, and lawnmower men.
Yep. In fact, there was a report in the Australian Financial Review today with the tax office saying that the partners in the Australian branches of the big four consultancy firms,
like KPMG,
are on average cutting their tax bill, their own personal tax bills, by 40% using tax minimization strategies. And they wrote half the rules about how the tax system works, and then half the people running the tax office are also former employees or partners in these consultancies. You couldn't make this stuff up.
So do some people use cash to dodge tax? Of course they do.
Yeah.
But is the problem serious enough to take cash away from the rest of us? Absolutely not, when the people recommending it are these people who have much more sophisticated ways to dodge tax. Thank you very much. They don't need cash to do it. And they want to put all the blame on the, like I said, they actually singled out in this report back in 2018, tradies, hairdressers, and guys who mow your lawn. Anyway, so just remember though, this is not charity. This is not Matt Common thinking about what's for the good of Australia. This is Matt Common talking about what's in the good for Commonwealth Bank. What's in it if they have a cash limit? Or get rid of cash entirely, which they would absolutely love to do. A cut of every transaction. We've often talked about this, right? They would like, and everyone's, I think there's all the memes going around, people are getting the point. Australia a few years ago was paying hundreds of millions of dollars in fees on electronic transactions and cards. Now we're paying something like $4 billion. Like massively, we're one of the most massively slugged countries in the world for transaction fees. Mm. And that banks get a cut of all of that and they want more, right? There's $100 billion in cash plus in circulation in Australia. It's a record amount. They want the more they can reduce of that, so it's not in circulation and those transactions are going through electronic systems, the more the banks get. They get data on all we do, and they want that data.
Mm.
And I did a show with Martin North last night about this, because in the Senate Bank Closures Inquiry, there was this exchange in the middle of the year, I think it was, between Senator Malcolm Roberts and the head of National Australia Bank. And the head of National Australia Bank, Ross McEwan, then had to admit that NAB can't measure any transactions that are done in cash, and they sure as hell want to. They wish they could. They wish they could. They want to know everything about you.
Mm.
Commonwealth Bank wants to know everything about you. There was an article about a month ago where Commonwealth Bank is looking at, is actively scouring your transactions in your account if you've got a mortgage with them, right, so that they can see preemptively whether you're going to have trouble with your mortgage.
Mm.
Right, they're spying on you
yeah.
to see if you might be a trouble going forward.
And if that weren't enough, they also monetize it. They on-sell your data. They use it to target products, financial products at you.
And AI now allow them to do all this predictive stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They hope. So it's, again, it's all about what's in it for them.
Yep.
They're not concerned about what's good for the country or their customers.
Now, there's some other things that are slightly less obvious, but it's worth people knowing what's in it for them. If they get rid of cash or reduce it mightily, they massively cut the cost of transporting cash.
Mm.
And they're screaming about that.
Yeah, which they're already trying to get out of it. They're trying to say, oh, well, the RBA should pay for it. Australia Post should do it. You know, everybody but us should do it. Why should they be the only business model without operating expenses? It's like, It's like your gas retailer saying that somebody should pay them to transport your gas and then they charge you for it anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's right. Well, good. That excellent analogy. That is exactly what they do. I was talking to an expert about this just before. There's this thing that they got brainwashed in with their MBA degrees starting in the 80s, and it's called cross-subsidization. So they were taught to put on this accountant's hat and look at every part of a business and go, oh, here you got a business with, and when it's a bank, say you got 100 units of the business, right? Because it's a big business. Oh, that unit, the cash part of this bank is being cross-subsidised by this, and it's being cross-subsidised by that. We do not want any cross-subsidisation. Cash has to stand on its own. Mm. So now we just look at the expense of cash, and Matt Comyn put a figure on it last year at a hearing, $400 million it costs the Commonwealth Bank to distribute cash around Australia.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, that's $400 million that's on the expenses side of the ledger. After which is all paid, they still make $10 billion profit.
Mm-hmm.
Cry me a river, right? That's their business's money. And they want to say that, oh, we need to reduce the cost of that part of the business. Cry me a river, for crying out loud. But anyway, so they think, well, if we get rid of cash, we can massively reduce that.
Mm.
And then that's extra profit for them. And, of course, the same thing with closing branches, the cost of maintaining branches, et cetera, and ripping out ATMs. It's all part of that picture. There's lots of money to be saved, which means money that goes in their profits, which means bigger bonuses for Matt Comyn. But then there's another part of it, and this is a little bit technical, but let me just explain it quickly. Cash is one of two forms that RBA liabilities exist in. So the Reserve Bank is our central bank, and its liabilities exist in two forms. One is physically printed cash, and the other is in the deposits that the private banks have in the accounts they have to hold with the RBA, called exchange settlement accounts. Now, the cash gets put into circulation is the banks, the private banks, say to the RBA, well, we have this much demand for cash. We need this much cash this week. So the RBA gives them the cash, but then debits their exchange settlement accounts by that much money.
Mm.
So that it's gone from electronic form from those accounts into cash. And, of course, when it's in cash, the banks are paying to circulate it. When it's in the electronic form, the banks are being paid.
They're being paid the overnight, the cash rate. Is what the RBA interest rate is.
That's what the RBA interest rate is. It's what they pay the banks on that money in that, which is electronic cash, the electronic form of cash. That's why it's called the cash rate. And they're now being paid 4.35% overnight, right? So if there's $100 billion of cash in circulation, there's actually more, maybe 110, 120. That's about $5 billion in interest payments from the RBA that the banks aren't getting because it's in physical form. So not only if they could get it back into electronic form, not only do they save the money on transporting it, they also get paid by the RBA to hold it there, right?
And nice work if you can get it.
Lovely work if you can get it. And this is what... And do they care how badly they inconvenience their customers by taking away cash? Of course not. Matt Comyn's not going to be there forever. He'll maximise his bonuses, walk off into the sunset, and then that's someone else's problem to deal with. And in one sense, Richard, I mean, they shouldn't be the bastards. This, like, the civic mindedness of bankers has collapsed over the last period for sure with the neoliberal ideology.
Mm.
But in a sense, that's not the problem. The problem is the governments who allow them to do it.
Yeah, because it's like the old Aesop fable, right? You don't blame the scorpion for stinging you. You just don't put yourself in a situation where you get stung by the scorpion
It's in his nature. All right, and the final thing, and this is quite serious. The last thing that's in it for Matt Comyn, they will trap us inside the banking system so we can never leave. The banking system becomes Hotel California, right? You will never be able to get away from bad banking. And bad banking specifically includes bail-in. And this is the big issue with bail-in. So after the global financial crisis, they introduced this. They came up with this policy called bail-in to be able to keep banks going that otherwise would have collapsed by taking your money to prop them up. And the big concern was, how do you do a policy like this without people getting wind of it and having a run on the banks, right? This is their perfect solution. Now, in Europe, they came up with certain ways to do it. And it's all a balls up. But this is their perfect solution to do that. And they want bail-in. So in our alert service this week, there's an article there by Elisa Barwick on the IMF just the other day in a blog made it clear how much they want bail-in because they've got bail-in. They want bail-in to be used. They've got bail-in. The blog complained that last year there were two banking crises, one in Europe and one in the United States, right? And the Europe one was Credit Suisse and the Swiss government had to bail it out. The other one was with these smaller banks in the United States. And both of them had to be resolved by the authorities. but they didn't use the resolution tools that the IMF and the Bank for International Settlements had developed, including bail-in. They didn't use it. And the IMF is complaining about that. And it's complaining they actually resorted to different forms of bailout to prop them up. Now, if the IMF is complaining about this, that's because they actually want this thing to be used, right? And this kind of system where we can't pull cash out of the banks, there's no sort of like honesty check on the banks anymore, and that kind of thing can just go ahead, right? And we'll never be able to escape it. That's what they want. However, back to Tuesday, Aussies are voting with their feet, right? And we're sending a very powerful message. We said after we defeated the cash ban in 2020, we said, look, we've sent the message to the politicians, but now the banks are clearly going ahead with trying to get rid of cash in a private way, use it or lose it. And so that's what this week was about. I just, as we talked about this morning, I think people, to appreciate the beauty of this, imagine you're in the next bank board meetings, right, where these bankers have been sitting around these boardrooms looking at all their measurables and going, oh, yeah, how are we progressing on this? How are we progressing on getting rid of cash? And all of them will be talking this at the next board meeting about, well, did you see what happened last Tuesday? Right? And there will be a whole bunch of unhappy bankers about that.
Yep, because...
Take pleasure.
Yeah, because they might not be able to monitor how much cash you spend, but they're the ones dispensing it, so they absolutely know how much you took out.
Exactly. And there will be figures... Next month, the RBA will release figures about how much was taken out of ATMs this month, and maybe even by the day, so we'll see what happens there. And finally, Richard, on this, just this is why we push a postal bank, right? Imagine we had a public post office, People's Bank, where every post office in Australia, 4,000 post offices, are outlets for a public bank. Just imagine that. And that bank would effectively, because the Reserve Bank is the government's bank now, the central bank, this would effectively be a retail arm of that bank. And then the Reserve Bank would have no trouble knowing how much cash it needs is required out there, because it would have 4,000 outlets, retail outlets in post offices, making clear how much is required, and would have all the infrastructure of Australia Post, which is a transportation company at the end of the day, the infrastructure to get it there, right? And all this garbage can be dealt with in one fell swoop.
Yeah, which Australia Post is saying that it doesn't have the infrastructure to do now, but that's an easy fix.
There's different...
Armoured cart, like they're still making them.
Exactly. wasn't it you were saying just put this colour on?
Yeah, just
take if, buy the
let,
trucks.
Let Armaguard go flop, acquire all their trucks and paint them red. Problem solved.
Australia Post logos. Okay. All right, we spent a bit of time on that. I wanted to leave a bit more time on this, but let's get into it. How Australia sacrificed its sovereignty to the five-eyed monster. Now, we're about to talk about something that's very difficult for Richard. Feel sorry for Richard, because every now and then I have to extract some kind of half concessions out of him that Anthony Albanese may have done something a little bit right, half right, maybe. And it's very difficult for this guy, so be compassionate. But this is actually a good sign, and I'm going to make Richard prove it. So what's happened is this. Despite all the things, other things we say about Albanese, he has, in the last couple of weeks, the news broke, he has removed the heads of ASIO and ASIS, the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation and the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, they're called the Director Generals, the Directors General, from the National Security Committee of Cabinet, where they were permanent members. And the real story is that should have broken is that they were permanent members of the National Security. He has removed that. Scott Morrison installed them as permanent members of the National Security Committee of the Cabinet. And Anthony Albanese has said, no, that's not going to happen anymore. We will call you as we need you. Right, so the cabinet will deliberate on what it needs to deliberate, and if they need to discuss something involving ASIO or ASIS, they'll call them in. Right, that's what Albanese has announced. Now, this is a reversal of what we're calling Morrison's soft coup, because there's three parts of his soft coup. He gave himself personally more power than any other prime minister in Australian history has ever had. Right, when he secretly appointed himself to those ministries, right?
I mean, even when Whitlam, Cairns, and Connor were the whole cabinet, at least there were still three of them, right?
Exactly. He was it. And nobody knew. So this was secret. He did this secretly.
Yeah, him and the Governor General. That's it.
Exactly. The Governor General who, you know, poor old David McBride has been trying to expose as the guy who, you know, is the real culprit in the war crimes thing. Anyway, so Morrison did that. Morrison installed these two directors general in the National Security Committee of Cabinet, unelected people, and he installed a character named Andrew Shearer, another National Security boffin, as the secretary, the permanent secretary of the Cabinet. And the thing is, what would you call it, a break with tradition or whatever? The Cabinet is for elected politicians.
Yeah,
elected
so far
ministers.
As we know, it had never happened before.
Yeah, Cabinet is for elected ministers. He was putting these unelected people all from the national security apparatus. And we want to talk about what that apparatus actually is. And by removing them, the usual suspects have been losing their minds. And these are the people who want war with China crowd, et cetera. I mean, it's people like James Patterson, Andrew Hastie, the Sky News crew, the Sky News guys, right?
The Australian newspaper, the usual suspects.
The usual suspects. So why is this significant and why is it a good thing? I'm going to say a few words and then I want Richard to tell a couple of stories. So the intelligence agencies, we've followed this subject really, really closely for a long time and we've researched it a lot. The intelligence agencies are the secret government machinery that's taken over our democratic system. And here's how, you've got to understand how this works. By setting up these permanent intelligence bodies post-World War II at the British insistence, and Richard will go through that, at first the politicians dealing with them actually had spine and inner strength. But now, in the 21st century, you've got politicians who grow up thinking this is normal. And so they're trying to do their job as politicians. We elected them, but they have accepted, by virtue of the existence of these bodies, that there is information about Australia and the world that must be kept from them. Well, they accept that. And so the people in these bodies, these intelligence agencies, have this enormous power that's out of reach of democratic accountability. Nobody knows. Because what they will say is, if a politician in Australia said to ASIO or ASIS, No, you come clean. You tell us what I want to know. ASIO will say, well, the reason we can't is because we share that information with our intelligence partners. The CIA says we can't. MI6 says we can't. And if that politician had enough gumption to demand it of ASIO, as soon as they are told, oh, no, the CIA says, or MI6 says, oh, okay, sorry, forget I said anything. Forget I asked, right? That's the power of this thing. So, and this is where the evil lies in the world today. The reason we have a world on a war footage is because footing all the time and a permanent war system and a military industrial complex, etc., is this apparatus. In his book Dangerous Allies, Malcolm Fraser noted that Australia has never been truly sovereign. His point was we have always been subservient to either the UK and now the US, and we would say the US and still the UK. At Federation, and what is this? I'll give you some details. At Federation in 1901, Australia was defined in the Constitution, you can go and read it now, as a self-governing colony under the Crown. That's what our Constitution says, not as a sovereign nation, a self-governing colony under the Crown. One of the features of that was we didn't do our own foreign policy. The Brits did.
Yeah, defence and foreign policy. It was all run by straight out of London.
All them, and we were happy with that. Yeah. Right? That's how we saw ourselves. We were British, right? We were fully British. It got really ridiculous in 1931. In 1931, the British Parliament passed the Statute of Westminster, which gave the colonies, finally, the right to do their own foreign policy. The British said, okay, you do it yourself, right? This is yours. We didn't ratify it. We weren't interested. The Menzies-Lyons government was not interested in accepting the responsibility of exercising our own foreign policy. Only when John Curtin took power a decade later in 1941 was that ratified. And I would say we had a seven-year period, Richard, from then until 1949, when we did have a government that exercised sovereignty. An example of that, if you want to see a symbol of it, is Curtin standing up to Churchill over the troops in North Africa, because Curtin said, we're being threatened by the Japanese, bring our troops back from North Africa. Churchill refused the great Churchill refused, and John Curtin had to stand up to him. And even when they were coming back, Churchill tried to reroute them to Burma, and John Curtin stood up to him again and made them come back, right? He showed real spine. That was a government that was exercising its sovereignty. It all changed in 1949. So in the 20 minutes or so, we've got a little bit less we've got left. Tell us the two stories. And the first one is about, because we're going to talk about these, we want to talk about ASIO and ASIS, which is the two organisations being kicked out of the National Security Cabinet. Tell us the story about how Ben Chifley was scammed into accepting ASIO.
Yep. So Australia had these wartime military intelligence, signals intelligence, and a civilian agency called the Commonwealth Investigation Service. There was the Criminal Intelligence Bureau as well. But these were the precursor, the forerunners to ASIO. MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence service, wanted a branch in Australia to get Chifley back under the thumb, to get Australia back under the thumb.
Not an Australian agency, a branch in Australia.
And so what they did was they cooked up this thing. They claimed they had these, they had decrypted and translated these Soviet, Russian intelligence cables from various sources and from, you know, diplomatic cover, official cover agents. The project was called Venona. It doesn't mean anything in any language. It's just a made-up word, V-E-N-O-N-A. So from 1946 onwards, they claimed they were reading these things in near real time from Australia about this massive Soviet spying operation. Why they would be spying on us, who knows? And MI5 says, this is why you need to establish a branch of our agency in your country to coordinate with us to stop this Soviet espionage. Now, Chifley, for whatever reason, agreed not to tell the rest of the government about that. He was briefed privately. And so they set
Just quickly, you know, I think it's on Stan. There's an old Australian series from the 80s called True Believers. Mm. And there's a scene in that where Chifley is told, we need you to establish ASIO. And he says, not interested, we don't want a secret police here.
Yeah.
So he actually had a reaction to it.
Yeah. And so what did they do? The British and Americans they threatened to cut off intelligence. They started restricting intelligence access, intelligence sharing, actually important military intelligence stuff as well as the other business. As leverage, and they said they convinced Chifley to set up this thing at there was a UN sponsored a UN conference on economic development matters that they held at the Lapstone Hotel in the Blue Mountains. It's now a military barracks or something.
They proposed what they called the Lapstone Experiment.
Yeah. So they said, we're going to invite all these people here. The Soviets are going to be there. Everybody else is going to be there. And we want your agencies. We're going to have our agencies do everything. The Postmaster General's Department tapped all the phones, the telegrams. They read all the mail, the Soviet envoy's mail. Went all through everything with a fine-toothed comb. Nothing. No spying, no communications, nothing at all. But MI6, Britain is saying, they come back a few days later or whatever, a week later. We've got these intercepts that show that they were spying on the other delegates and that they were recruiting sources and that they were doing this and that and the other.
Your guys weren't up to the job.
Yeah, you guys weren't up to the... And that's what finally convinced Chifley, after he'd initially told them, and I quote, go to Hades.
That's pretty strong words for 1949.
He said, all right, okay, we'll establish this thing. And so that was the creation of ASIO. None of these supposed intercepts were actually available to anybody. They were held by the MI5 liaison.
So MI5 saying, trust us, we've got this evidence.
Yeah, in his safe. They're not sharing how they were decrypted. They're not doing any of that. Just here's the files. When this project, Venona, was declassified in the mid-1990s,
after the fall of the Soviet Union.
So the Russians turned around and declassified their own NKVD, the Soviet Foreign Intelligence Service, documents, showing that they'd had an agent in U.S. Signals Intelligence, the forerunner to the NSA, since 1945, who kept them up to speed on this thing the whole way through, and as soon as they cracked the decryption, they stopped using it for anything important. The latest that any of that happened was in... 1948, the year before all of this you know, the lapstone thing was at the end of 48, and ASIO was established in 49.
This lapstone thing, they had absolute surveillance on the Soviets, wall-to-wall surveillance, phone taps, etc. Found nothing. MI5 says, "Oh, but we've got these documents from, we've intercepted in real time these documents that prove they were spying."
Hmm.
And 50 years later, or whatever it was, the Soviets show that, hang on, we knew that Venona thing had been, was.
Yeah, yeah. So this guy, this agent, his name was William Weisband. He was an ethnic German Russian from an emigre family, or claimed to be. There's argument about whether maybe he was actually born in Russia. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he was there from 1945. The Australian intercept supposedly started in 46. So he's there telling them everything. He was a linguist, not a crypto analyst, code breaker, but he was working, he was the linguist, the translator for the code breakers. So he knew everything about this program, and he was telling them everything the whole way through.
So the Soviets weren't using them.
No, as soon as they knew this code had been cracked in whatever country, they just started using it for sending just random nonsense, just spam, basically, we'd call it now, press clippings, all this sort of stuff, just to keep them busy, and didn't use it for anything important ever again.
But MI5 is lying.
So MI5 is telling Chifley, we've got these live intercepts from your meeting, can't have happened.
Just so they could scam him into setting up, agreeing to set up a branch of them in Australia.
Yep.
All right. That's one story. Now, I already knew that story before this week. I didn't know this one. So ASIO is a domestic spy agency in Australia. ASIS, Australian Secret Intelligence Service, is the foreign spy agency.
Yeah.
And they're essentially the branch of MI6, which is its proper name is Secret Intelligence, SIS.
Yeah, the MI thing comes from, they were started out as just different sections of British military intelligence. Yeah. So,
how did ASIS start in Australia?
There were people lobbying, people who had worked in military intelligence with the British, Australians from Blue Blood families, including the guy Alfred Deakin Brooks, who became the inaugural director of ASIS once it was set up in 52 by Menzies. He's the grandson of Alfred Deakin, the second Prime Minister. So they've been trying to convince everyone since Chifley wouldn't, if he wasn't going to come at ASIO, he certainly wasn't going to come at setting up an Australian branch of MI6.
Yeah.
Menzies would, British to his bootstraps, Bob Menzies. But they didn't do it by legislation.
But before you get to that, isn't there some kind of evidence that they were actually briefing the Liberals in opposition while Chifley was still in government and preparing them for this?
Yeah, so it's been said, there's... This was talked about in a speech to the Menzies Institute by a researcher on this stuff. I haven't seen the documents,
but
they do exist.
So MI6 go behind the back of the elected Australian government to prepare the future government.
Yeah, the opposition that they wanted in there. Yeah. There are documents saying that, declassified and leaked cables saying that they would have preferred to deal with the Liberals.
So how did Menzies start it?
Well, there was an argument in the cabinet, do we put legislation, put all its modus operandi in law, make it public.
Which you're supposed to.
Make it public that it even exists.
Yeah.
Menzies said, no, he created it using royal prerogative powers of the Governor-General devolved to the Prime Minister.
It's called the Executive in Council, where you can issue executive orders, basically.
Yeah.
If you and the Governor-General agree, then it's on.
Yeah. So in 1952, he creates this thing, not just modelled on MI6, but explicitly as a branch of MI6 in Australia. Keeps it secret from the rest of the Parliament, and it was secret from the rest of the Parliament except for the Executive, which is the Prime Minister and what's now known as the National Security Committee of the Cabinet, which is what Albanese's just removed these two people from.
Yeah.
It was kept secret for the next 25 years from... from all parliamentarians besides those people who were directly involved in portfolios that had to interface with it. Gough Whitlam didn't even know about it until he became Prime Minister and he was briefed on its existence. There were leaks before that, suggestions that there was this thing, but nobody knew actually what it was.
And Gough Whitlam was one who later made it public?
No, it was made public in 1977. So
okay.
Fraser
made it public.
It was officially acknowledged at that point.
But now this part's fascinating because the better part of the story is the same government that started it was about to shut it down within the first few years. So why and why did they stop?
Well, this guy Brooks would have fit right in with Scott Morrison.
Right.
Complete authoritarian nut job. He's lobbying ministers to have ASIS, MI6, made the foreign policy, the agency that develops and implements Australian foreign policy.
Oh, him.
Him, yeah. MI6 via him.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, MI6, yeah.
And so all this sort of stuff, running around just not... He's supposed to be accountable to the ministers for defence and external affairs, as it was then, now DFAT. The last straw was in 1957, so he's been in the job 5 years. Early 1957, he flies without sanction from his ministers to Washington, D.C. to confer with the head of... with the Secretary of State, the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. John Foster's the Secretary of State. Alan Dulles is the head of the CIA. MI6 counterpart in America.
And if you know anything about these guys and this history, these are dirty as.
So he flies there to discuss with them a plan. Who knows who developed it? This is all in this lecture by this Menzies Institute. It's on YouTube. We'll put a link to it. So he flies there in early 1957 and says to discuss with the Dulles brothers a plan whereby American long-range nuclear missiles might be stationed in Australia in secret from the people.
Behind the back of our government, he did this.
Without their permission, certainly. So the cabinet freaked out and said, no, this has gone to... we're shutting this down. Menzies was off on medical leave. He was having surgery for something or other. The cabinet meets in May 1957, says, okay, we're abolishing ASIS. As soon as word of this is heard, which is basically immediately, they get the Chifley treatment. Americans cut off intelligence.
The Dulles brothers cut off intelligence.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. They cut off intelligence sharing with Canberra.
Yep.
And the deputy director of MI6 is sent to Australia for what this academic, this researcher guy, described as a five-day blitz of senior politicians and public servants telling you reinstate... Don't you dare abolish our agency. Because understand, this agency was run by MI6. They designed the missions. They ran through MI6 stations in Asia and
everything
places.
For MI6.
Yeah, it was just part of MI6.
It was MI6, yeah.
And eventually they got... Menzies came back from his medical leave and overruled the cabinet. And said, no, we're keeping ASIS. And then it was secret for another 20 years.
So the same Menzies who started it against the wishes of the cabinet as a secret thing came back and rescued it.
Yeah, and so that's what ASIS... That's where ASIS came from. It's a control mechanism. ASIO and ASIS between them.
The point of these stories is very important. These were imposed on Australia.
Yeah.
Imposed on us by our British masters, who don't have a democratic system, mother of parliaments, all this garbage. They don't have a democratic system. Malcolm Turnbull made a name for himself as a young lawyer because he defended Peter Wright in the famous Spycatcher trial, the former head of MI5 who came to Australia and wrote a book about MI5 called Spycatcher, and he breached Britain's Official Secrets Act and Margaret Thatcher wanted to have him arrested, and Turnbull defended him. And one of the things that Peter Wright revealed in the book was MI5 and MI6 did not consider MI5 officers didn't consider themselves loyal to the government. They considered themselves personally loyal to the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Not the government, not the elected government, the Queen. And by us having these agencies in Australia as imposed on us, we were accepting the same system.
Yeah, in fact, a very well-known, he's passed away a couple of years ago now, Desmond Ball, Australian researcher and academic expert in national security state and all that. He and another guy wrote a book back in the 80s and saying that, MI5, the ASIO and ASIS used to call London head office.
Head office, yeah.
Because it was.
Yep.
And
here was main office or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. The Melbourne headquarters, as it was then, was main office.
That's what they oriented. This is what they are. So now, and what, just have to mention this briefly if you want to get almost conspiratorial here. But one incident most Australians may know of that involved ASIS, because most Australians wouldn't know what ASIS has ever done. Mm. Apparently, ASIS was involved in the coup in Chile. In 1974, it was Australian ASIS agents over there helping to organise that coup that brought in the fascist Pinochet regime, overthrew a democratically elected government. But more famous is the wiretapping of the Timor-Leste embassy to help out Woodside. And the guy who organised that was Alexander Downer. Mm. Alexander Downer ordered us for the negotiation, ordered ASIS to wiretap the embassy. The guy who eventually blew the whistle... Witness K, I think his Witness
that's
K.
What he's known as.
We never found out his identity. But who was Alexander Downer? He is Mr. Five Eyes in Australia. In fact, we wrote an article once called "What Has Five Eyes and Wears Fishnet Stockings." And remember when Trump got elected and Trump was saying all this stuff against NATO and freaking everybody out? Who went and set up that guy, Trump's guy, George
Papadopoulos
in London? Alexander Downer,
yep.
Right? And that led to all the whole Russiagate rubbish, etc. So there's an example of how MI5 sort of operates. And now actually Downer is part of this thing called the Hakluyt Group, which is all these former MI6 officers.
Former.
Right? Doing all this private intelligence kind of stuff. But these were imposed on us. And go back to what I said earlier. If you're a member of parliament, who has the responsibility, the quite awesome responsibility of representing the people who've elected you in parliament, and you make it to the government, and you're in the cabinet, sitting around that room, and you are the government, and you're supposed to know everything. Mm. We accept there needs to be some secrets on some stuff, but not from the government. Mm. There shouldn't be secrets kept from the government. But the existence of this apparatus, they accept, because these partnership relationships are so important, they accept that.
Yeah, and just... probably more significant than Albanese just putting things back to normal, really, is the reaction to it. Because it shows you how freaked out they are that anybody might challenge any aspect of this control mechanism. Even just, because the whole thing about, what we always talk about, grassroots activism works.
Yes.
And if those guys aren't there in the room, and this is what Patterson and Hastie keep going on about, they need to be in the room. Well, they never were before.
Exactly.
And they had plenty of influence then. But things are such now...
The big shift against antagonism toward China, the talk of war.
Yeah.
These guys were installed in the cabinet, and you don't have to praise him, but I'll praise him. You can stay neutral. No, and not to really praise him. Albanese has shown that whatever his personal views is, he is capable of responding, feeling he has to respond to the public pushing him on stuff.
Yeah,
right.
Not to mention the entire left wing, his wing of his own party.
Exactly. This is an incredibly significant shift, and the freak out actually proves it. And it's significant because of the freak out, like Richard said, you're right. It only takes it back to what it was before that. We haven't suddenly embraced our sovereignty again. But they clearly wanted these guys in there for a reason.
They're terrified that we might.
The movement is in the right direction. And it's a good opportunity to learn something about how the world really works. And the fact, this is why people, we aren't not a sovereign country. These agencies are why we're not a sovereign country. All right, Richard, excellent. Thank you very much. We will put the link to the full speech on that below and the other things that we've talked about during the show. Thanks to the viewer for tuning in. Tune in next time for more of the Citizens Report.
Authorised by Robert Bowick, Citizens Party, Melbourne.